Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 18th of January 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. We're also joined by David Scott, and of course, David reporting from north of the border with northern exposure. The love affair, Mike.
We're going to get straight on with this. David, the Aachen Treaty, we're only a couple of days away from it being signed. Is it Tuesday it gets signed?
That's right, it's Tuesday 22nd.
So just briefly, give us some background to what this is for anybody that doesn't know.
Well, it's an idea that's actually quite new. It's all happened in a year. So a year ago on the anniversary of the signing of the Alesi Treaty in 1963, 55th anniversary then, it was decided to renew this and there was going to be a new treaty. So it's only taken a year to bring it forward. It's been done very quietly because there's very little information out there. We've got some for the viewers today, but up until this point, one or two selected journalists had been allowed to see the treaty, but nothing had been published. So it's advertised as a renewal of the Berlin Paris Accords and the close relationship between the two largest countries on the continent of Europe.
Okay, so we'll just point out before we move on that, that you have written an article on this. It's on the UK Column website at the moment. The headline is, "Will the new Treaty of Aachen make the EU dream come true?" And so the question, David, is, will it make the EU dream come true? And if so, in what way?
Well, this is what we're trying to get to. The symbolism would suggest it's very important. Aachen was the capital of Charlemagne, the father of Europe, right? It was where 31 Holy Roman Emperors were crowned. It's a place where treaties have been signed in the past. And the symbolism around this is all very kind of empire-ish. We're going to see this treaty signed in the coronation hall in Aachen Town Hall in Gothic splendor. So we're looking back to the past of Europe and it being united, and we're looking to the more recent past where the EU has formed, and then we're making there's lots of comments about EU military unification in various forms, not quite using those words, but what exactly it means is a little difficult to pin down.
So this is going to be signed on Tuesday, and one of the other features of this is that apparently they've organised for ratification to happen on the same day. It's all seeming to happen very quickly.
It does seem to be in reaction to something. Could that be Brexit? It's ratification by both the French and German parliaments the same day. There's a separate parliamentary agreement, which I understand is going to form a parliamentary council with 50 MPs from both parliaments meeting on a regular basis to discuss common issues. So we're seeing, and there's lots of items in the agreement that rather break down the concept of a border. If you're going to have, for example, medical care provided by a single entity on both sides of the border, well, that runs across huge governmental interests, taxation and all the rest of it. So is this a wedge issue? Because that's most certainly included. Medical care, nursery care, education, etc. will be provided across the border without the border having any significance. So are we seeing here the remnants of the European borders being eroded and basically removed?
Okay, that's a good question. But the one thing that we were discussing before the programme that struck us was the issue of what seems to be some kind of Franco-German customs union. And so the question then is, why would they be establishing some kind of common trading area when surely that situation is covered by the European Union?
Well, yes, I mean, Article 20 reads the two states will deepen the integration of their economies in order to establish a Franco-German economic zone with common rules. I thought we had that since about the mid-1960s. So what does that mean?
Well, yeah. What I pick up from this, David, is that we've now got the push for proper regionalisation within the European Union. So we're going to break down the national boundaries, but within the overall empire, because that's what they're calling it, the empire of the European Union. We're going to have these regions, and those are going to be part of the power base, along with the city states. Presumably, they'll try and identify that. What I picked up with this was that, as well as talking about stuff moving seamlessly across borders, they were also talking about the need to set up joint enterprise, whatever that was to be, could be medical, could be military, industrial, on the borders themselves. So they're saying we need to actually have stuff placed right on the border, so that people presumably can see that the border no longer means anything. I think this is regionalisation within the EU.
Oh, it's certainly that, but also the biggest section is on defence and security. And one clause from that reads, the two states undertake to strengthen further the cooperation between their armed forces with a view to establishing a common culture and joint deployments. They are intensifying the development of common defence programmes and are expanding them to partners. I think that means us. In doing so, they intend to promote the competitiveness and consolidation of the European defence industrial and technological base. That could have been written by David Ellis. That's exactly what David Ellis has been telling us for some years now is coming.
So that that raises an interesting question, because obviously they signed this treaty. We already have bilateral treaties signed, not only the Lancaster House treaties from 2010, but the Sandhurst Treaty from January 2018 between Britain and France, particularly focusing, amongst other areas, on defence. But actually, if you look at the Sandhurst Treaty documentation, the breadth and depth of it is quite similar to what you seem to be describing with the Aachen Treaty here. So if we have a treaty arrangement with France along these lines, France has a treaty arrangement with Germany along these lines, perhaps somebody with better legal understanding of the implications of this are, but does that therefore follow that we somehow end up with rules that we have to follow with regard to Germany?
Quite possibly. And amongst those rules, there is a requirement for France and Germany to go to one another's aid militarily, you know, with military force, if their territory is invaded or attacked in any way. So that would be a replacement for any NATO agreement, I suppose.
Let's just move on from this. But before we do, what did the European Council on Foreign Relations have to say about it?
Well, at least they said something about it, although that was half an hour of my life I won't get back. They agreed it was very symbolic. They used the word symbolic rather a lot. There seemed to be no detail, but they hadn't actually read it when they did this, to be fair to them. So they were kind of filling a bit. So, yes, it's symbolic, but they're not sure why.
Yeah, OK. Well, look, we're talking about military union and so on, and this whole European business has been going on for a long time. And we have another article here on the UK column website that I've written called Military Union, British Government Policy Since 1948. And this came from a document that was sent on to us from via a viewer and listener from Q, the National Archives. And basically what it shows is that, in 1947, because of concerns over the Soviet Union, Russia was the enemy. Coming out of the Second World War, Russia was becoming the enemy, and Britain in particular was pushing very anti-Soviet Russian rhetoric. So Britain and France concerned about that. So they signed a mutual assistance pact in Dunkirk in March 1947. And then in January 1948, the Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin gave a speech in the House of Commons where he was using the threat of Russia as the justification for creating what was called a Western Union, which was a military union between Britain, France, and the Benelux countries of Belgium, Netherlands and Luxembourg. And I just wanted to highlight a couple of things from this report, because the treaty was signed in March. This was a treaty of Brussels, which established the Western Union. It was signed in March of 1948, and then in April he went to Paris, and he produced a report on the implementation meeting that took place in Paris. So what it says in this report is the other foreign ministers, particularly Monsieur Bido, The French foreign minister were naturally much concerned with the recent events in Europe, and consequence emphasis was laid on the urgent need for an early examination of the military situation. It was felt that whilst American support was essential and every effort should be made to secure it, the five powers should simultaneously initiate military conversations designed to build up gradually to a combined military force and a single defensive organisation for all the treaties. Now, the Western Union existed, I think, until 1954. And at that point, other countries were starting to join and so on. But the military aspect of this was merged in with NATO. And so the question then is this discussion here of building up gradually to combine military force and a single defensive organization sort of in the NATO model? And so that's the question. But actually, earlier in the document, in fact, in the first main paragraph, they're talking about the main reason for holding this implementation meeting. And what they say is that the main purpose of the Paris meeting was to reach agreement on the organization of a consultative council, and in particular, the choice of a capital as its permanent seat. Now, David, any definition of the word capital that I've ever seen refers to the legislative body for a state. And so if you put that in, you put this issue of combined military force in the context of a state with a legislative body, this looks a bit more than a NATO-style organisation.
It certainly does. And we've seen this is from obviously the Labour administration, but we've seen similar statements from Churchill to the effect that Europe has to be united. And it was always assumed that he meant without us in it. But it doesn't appear that that's the case, because there's certainly no distinction here being drawn between Britain's position and that of the rest of Europe. In fact, we're in it from the very start.
Well, what's absolutely clear is that this was a Franco-British, a British-French initiative. They're talking about, it's not just military, it's other areas as well. They're talking about economic cooperation, financial cooperation, social and cultural. So let's just leave it with Mr. Bevan himself and what he said. He said, that these other areas, the economic, financial, social, cultural union, will help us keep the governments of policies in line and so serve the common purpose. And this seems to have been the British policy at the time. And so, bearing in mind that this all happened several years before Jean Monnet started his campaign to build a European Union, Brian, this has got to be significant. And yeah, if bringing all these countries together, as he describes it, with a common purpose, helps keep the policies of governments in line, that's pretty strong language.
Well, it's a conspiracy in the proper sense of the word, Mike, and those words common purpose, I think, are highly significant, because that is what's going on here. And when we see these people talking about either distracting the British public with other things so that this can all go through and there won't be too much trouble from the common man, or we're seeing documents and statements where they say we're going to use propaganda to help us get this common purpose through. This is very, very sinister political engineering, isn't it?
And many parallels to what's going on today, it seems.
Indeed, yeah. So perhaps we can say to our viewers and listeners that if this is the sort of area that you have researched or you could research, then please get digging. Some of the documentation that we're now showing is at the moment exclusive to the UK column, originally sourced thanks to a viewer from the Kew archives. And this is very, very important documentation, because, of course, it's what the government at the time was saying and doing.
And it was classed as top secret at the time.
And that particular document, was classed as top secret. And at the moment, there are other documents which still require work, which are declassified secret documents from the time. So clearly, there was a need for this secrecy in order to keep this plan from the public in UK. Well, let's jump to Leave Means Leave. And again, we're going to say big thanks to one of our viewers who highlighted that Nigel Farage was speaking at the Leave Means Leave rally yesterday, and we've put in the headlines here that he finally highlighted the EU Defence Union. Well, only nearly, because he didn't. But let's have a look at what he did say. So this was part of his speech to the audience. Now we have Mr. Juncker telling us that by 2025, there will be a European Army, Navy and Air Force. On the 9th of May this year, Mrs. Merkel, the real boss, of course, of Europe, and Mr. Macron, whose star may have fallen somewhat, but they will be giving a further press conference announcing further deep sweeping reforms. What they mean is a further centralisation of power. And we'll come back to that statement. We'll just finish off with this one. He goes on to say this: the European project is about building a unitary state. It's about getting rid of the nation states as effective operating entities. Far from Remain having a bit of certainty, we would have plunged further into, frankly, regional irrelevance. So let's be clear, Brussels isn't working, and right across Europe, there are people rising up on the right, the centre and the left, saying they wish to govern their own countries. So very interesting, Mike, that months after particularly the UK column, but also the British Constitution Group, were hammering Leave Means Leave, and indeed speaking to Nigel Farage himself to say, why aren't you talking about EU military unification? Last night, he got about as close to it as he could, because he finally acknowledged it isn't an EU army. It's actually tri-service. But he still didn't use the words. He still didn't talk about defence union. He still didn't talk about military unification. And he still didn't really emphasise that UK has already been signed into it. Now, before David, I just ask you for a bit of analysis on what's going on. Let's just bring this on screen, because we want to remind people that we've now got the European Union talking about defence union itself. This is very well-crafted language. It's Aesopian, it's sort of hidden meaning, because the real meaning of what's going on here is that this is tri-service, Army, Navy and Air Force, military unification. It will include nuclear weapons, including Britain's nuclear weapons and nuclear deterrent. It will include the defence industry and procurement, together with all security forces and structure. So the EU talks about defence. When it does that, it means military and security. And ultimately, the police will be brought in with that. Just think about how Europe's police are behaving with the yellow jackets in France. But this will come together with an EU treasury, which has already been declared, and of course, taxation. And the key point, which Nigel Farage is still not talking about, is that Theresa May and the Conservatives have already signed us into this defence union by use of these bilateral agreements, which you've just mentioned. David, if you try and analyse Nigel Farage, it is so difficult. I will state again that if you follow him through, to me, he's waved a flag. He's got all of those voters behind him. And just at the point where we had 17.4 million people who'd voted Brexit wanting leadership, he then departs the public. He departs the party, but he still appears in public with Trump in America. And now what is he doing here? He's taken months, even though he's been provided the information, to speak out these defence issues.
Yeah, he departed at an incredible time, having won a great victory. Although you'll remember on the night, the exit polling said that Leave had lost. And he was interviewed about this. And rather than saying, let's wait for the real results, he said, well, the fight goes on, so we'll need another referendum, essentially. That was a very strange thing to say, particularly as it's worked out. And the key for me is the EU military unification. He won't use the words. He knows what we're saying, right? He's had many, many people raise this with him, and he won't use the words. The German government are using the words. The German government, about the Aachen Agreement, said under the new treaty, military cooperation is also to be stepped up. This will include the development of joint strategic approaches, including the design of the European Defence Union. So it's out there. The German government in a press release are talking about this, but still Nigel Farage won't. And he won't say union or unification because it's our military that's going in there. And that's the point that the people of this country need to be made aware of. That's the point he won't talk about.
Okay, well, we're going to put up effectively an advert for the UK column here, because it's only the UK column that has actually been talking about this immensely important area. Virtually nothing in any of the other mainstream papers, certainly nothing on the BBC or Sky or the rest of it. So we are going to say that it's only the UK column that's consistently warned that there was never a plan for the EU army. We've published that information. And if you go to the UK column website, have a look at that EU military unification timeline to get the overview. And now we're supporting it with these declassified papers from 1948 and shortly other, explaining that actually this plan was born out of the heart of the British government itself.
Right. Well, let's come on to the issue of propaganda now. And this is the DSTL. And it's very interesting because, Exercise Trident Juncture, which was the big NATO exercise in November last year, is what these images are from. It's happened several months ago, but today they've decided to issue a press release all about their specialists from the Defence Science and Technology Laboratory who were testing NATO strategic communications during Exercise Trident Juncture. So they're saying that a strategic communications specialist from DSTL said, this is about winning the information war as well as the frontline war. We need to combine what we know about both elements to be successful. Online media has changed the way we do business in this area. So what are they talking about? Well, they're saying that DSTL worked with NATO's Public Diplomacy Division, the Joint Warfare Centre and Supreme Allied Command Transformation to deliver an assessment of the tools NATO used for public engagement around the exercise. Results revealed better public engagement, as well as the development of a framework which will allow NATO to achieve the information advantage. Now, that strategic communications specialist went on to say, we provided evidence which changed the way NATO did business in terms of their external communications for the exercise and for future processes. In 5 weeks, we're able to identify, analyse and assess and then advise NATO communicators on how they could use online media to their best advantage. The impact was huge. We effected significant change in terms of cut through of positive messaging about NATO. The work involved tracking hashtags and sentiment, monitoring the information environment and advising NATO on how to gain traction and impact with its online presence. Analysis of external media was also tracked alongside NATO's own communications about the exercise. Also, they mentioned this person, the Information Fusion Cell Director. What a title. I'd like to know a little bit more about that from Joint Forces Command in Naples, who said that the scientists are inspirational ambassadors for DSTL. But David, it strikes me that what we have here is, how do we describe it? This is propaganda on an unprecedented scale. And if we look at this in terms of the counter disinformation program at the Foreign Office and the Integrity Initiative, we're now using DSTL staff to teach NATO how to use social media to make sure that everybody has a positive impression of what NATO is and its exercises.
And the communication that we're not getting is the communication that says, watch out for the oil tanker, right? Because that's not happening. How many ships have gone down, including the recent Norwegian exercise?
Was actually Trident Juncture that happened.
Yes. There seems to be, there's a kind of unreality to it all. We're going to win the information war. We're going to pretend really effectively, we're going to out-pretend the Russians, right? The Russians are useless at pretending. We're going to pretend to a much higher standard, and we're going to craft a narrative. And that will form the main thrust of the strategy, rather than, as it used to be the case, to actually have defence forces that can defend the nation. That's no longer relevant in this brave new world that we're looking at. We have to craft a narrative, because the main target for this is the people of Britain, the people of Europe, and the people of the West. Those are the people who have to be changed, because otherwise they won't accept what's already been decided for them. It's not really about defence.
I'll just add a bit to that. I think the other thing going on here is that they have created chaos inside Britain's military. They are clearly using disruptors and disruption techniques. And why do you want to do this? Because it comes back to this business of changing the direction of a very large, stable organisation. We've seen this done with the NHS. You want to privatise the NHS, but it's doing its best. It's stable. It's providing reasonably good treatment. That's not good enough. You've got to get people in there to destabilise it so that it can be made chaotic and pushed in a new direction. I think exactly the same thing is being undertaken in the military. And it's fascinating that this isn't only going on in Europe. Of course, we're seeing this chaos breaking out inside the US military. So presumably there's some future plan for the US military as well. My feeling is that they ultimately want the US military to shrink. They want it brought back. Because the plan is the trilateral plan for the American, the European and the Asian bloc. But that's just my personal opinion.
Okay, so in order to compensate for that, they've got to push out propaganda and keep a narrative going.
Keep the narrative going, keep people focused.
And the last thing you want is anybody countering that narrative. So we'll be pleased, and everybody would be pleased to know that Full Fact, the well-known fact-checking charity, has been given a contract by Facebook to manage Facebook's fact-checking mechanisms, which have now come to the UK. The fact-checking initiative has reached the UK at last. So they say this month, Full Fact is going to begin fact-checking images, videos and articles on Facebook in the bid to slow the spread of misinformation on people's news feeds. Since 2016, the social network has been working with fact-checkers worldwide to develop its third-party fact-checking initiative, and now it's reached the UK. So Facebook users will be able to flag up content. Any content that's flagged up will go into a queue, and Full Fact will have access to that queue. They'll pick the stories that they want to pick off the queue, and they will check the facts that are presented in the article, and they will present counter-articles if necessary. But in the meantime, then, if you have an article which is flagged on your newsfeed, or on your page, then that will result in a strike. And if you manage to persuade Full Fact that, in fact, you were speaking the truth and your facts are correct, then that strike will be removed. But if you can't persuade them of that, then the strike will stand. And what's also interesting is that if you share information and somebody else who's running a Facebook page, if one of those admins allows your post to appear on their page and your post is then flagged as being false, that their page will get a strike as well. And what's interesting as well is that simply removing the content, once you've discovered that the content was false in some way, doesn't remove the strike. So what they're doing is pretty insidious in a sense, because they're making sure that there's as much of a reduction in sharing as possible. They want to instill fear in anybody that's running a page, because somebody that's built some reputation on a page doesn't want to see that reputation disappear as a result of effectively fake news strikes. So, David, let me just ask you, are you, you know, feeling comfortable with the fact that that this little charity, Full Fact, has been given a contract? They won't say what the value of the contract is at the moment. In fact, what they said, I believe, is that they don't know exactly how much money they're going to end up getting from Facebook yet, but they will be publishing that as time goes on. But you must feel comfortable about this.
When you see the quality of the people doing the fact checking and the political The political allegiance of those people, a lot of them are what we would describe as members of the cult. They view the world in a particular way. They've been framed to think in a particular way. That doesn't leave me with a warm feeling at all. I mean, I when you started to describe this, I thought, well, this is like the Moody's and Standard & Poor's rating agency, but for truth. And that's not a very good thing. But actually, it's probably worse than that. We've got an organisation like Moody's, etc., that will only survive if it says the things that are wanted from it, and will only receive money if it says the things that are wanted from it. So it's simply a way of controlling and censoring the internet and doing it one step removed, so that Facebook is not seen as the censoring state-aligned bully that it probably is. Mm.
Well, David, if that censoring is on the internet, let's not forget that, of course, the BBC has now got these so-called democracy reporters embedded in local papers. Certainly one of our viewers hadn't forgotten, so they'd flagged up some things happening with the Real Journal. We'll keep this very simple, but essentially this is what they had to say, that the BBC local democracy reporter from the Real Journal was doing a fine job in Wales, even if he does say so himself. It says the LDR for Real Journal not only reports but writes of his own successes. Here he is pretending he has a hard but vital job keeping a diary of meetings. Bless him, so hard it must be to look at the schedule of meetings on the council website. His success since he joined in March. And since then, the number of stories on Conway and Denbighshire has increased massively on previous years. You don't say. He also mentions councillors giving him titbits, to which the viewer says, oh dear, causing trouble must be part of his job to destroy local media and local councils. In the last few years, both Conway and Denbighshire Council have fought off two attempts at a merger. A Denbighshire contact tells me they're facing more cuts in addition to outsourcing more services, including council tax. I wonder if this dolt of a reporter will be instrumental in swaying the next attempt at a merger by his reporting on matters known to anger the residents. Then we'll be nearer to, quote, one council for North Wales. Mm. And I just thought that was such an excellent little pickup on the fact that the BBC is now embedded right down to local paper level.
Let's head over the Atlantic briefly, David, and an amusing little story here, because we have Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi, who love each other to bits, as you can see on screen there. But unfortunately, they love each other so much that Donald couldn't bear to be separated from her. So he wrote her a letter saying that due to the shutdown, dear Madam Speaker, due to the shutdown, I'm sorry to inform you that your trip to Brussels, Egypt and Afghanistan has been postponed. We will reschedule this 7-day excursion when the shutdown is over. In light of the 800,000 great American workers not receiving pay, I'm sure you would agree that postponing this public relations event is totally appropriate. I also feel that during this period, it would be better if you're in Washington negotiating with me and joining the strong border security movement to end the shutdown. Obviously, if you would like to make your journey by flying commercial, that would certainly be your prerogative. I look forward to seeing you soon, and even more forward to watching our open and dangerous southern border finally receive the attention, funding and security it so desperately deserves. So, David, this has got to be viewed as Trump at his finest.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's just glorious. There are times when he lets us down. There's times when he's a disappointment. The economics. But there are times when it comes to puncturing pompous people who have enriched themselves at the expense of the ordinary working man and woman for decades. It's a thing of beauty. And that letter is joyful. She can... excursion. Oh yeah. I enjoyed that immensely.
Yes. Okay. Well, okay. Any thoughts?
I was only going to say, I think we're unfortunately going to get another tick in the fact we must be amazing pro-Trump supporters for doing this, because of course the UK column is now being watched and evaluated on our content. So I think we're going to get another black spot there, Mike.
Absolutely. David, we'll head up to Scotland now. What's going on with the named person scheme? Just remind everybody what this is.
Well, the named person scheme was the SNP administration's idea that a state guardian would be appointed to every child from conception, essentially, until they were 18. And this named person would be responsible for overseeing their upbringing and making sure they were happy, because they had to look after something called well-being, which couldn't be defined. And if the named person had any sort of gut feel that something might be wrong, they could share information about that person or any associated adult with whomsoever the named person would choose in order to decide what to do to intervene in that family. And this was fought by the No to Named Person campaign, led by the Christian Institute. And it went all the way down to the Supreme Court, because both the inner and outer houses of the Scottish court session had decided this was fine. So we were abandoned by our judiciary on that occasion. But the Supreme Court ruled it unlawful and said, amongst other things, they mentioned the T word, totalitarianism. And there's been a lot of discussion that the Scottish government have tried to roll back from this and say somehow, well, they weren't really calling us totalitarian. Well, it's been clarified now. This is Lady Hale speaking at a keynote address to a legal group in the Isle of Man. And she said the spectre of the totalitarian state, which tried to separate children from the subversive influence of the families, loomed large. The Supreme Court recognised this in the Christian Institute versus Lord Advocate judgment. The case which challenged the Scottish named person scheme said, the first thing that a totalitarian regime tries to do is to get at the children, to distance them from the subversive, varied influences of their families and to indoctrinate them in the ruler's view of the world. Within limits, families must be left to bring up their children in their own way. Those words have haunted the Scottish government and continue to do so. So that makes it very clear that this was a threat that the Supreme Court considered was looming large.
But the problems for the scheme continue.
Oh, yes. Here's a very pensive, there's a well-chosen photograph here by the Scotsman. So the Scottish government tried to fix this. So they brought forward another bill to correct the fact that the bill was unlawful. The new bill didn't even get to the Scottish Parliament because at committee stage, it was viewed to be basically incomprehensible. And the Scottish government said, well, you won't understand what the bill means until you see the code of practice. So the committee said, well, can we see the code of practice? And the Scottish government said, well, we haven't written that yet. So it all stopped. And the committee said, no, we need to see the code of practice. So the Scottish government then commissioned a group to go and write the code of practice on information sharing for a situation which is fundamentally unlawful. And then the committee decided, well, we have a problem here. Let's have a subcommittee to look at the legal aspects. And then the whole thing is stopped because it can't find a way forward. So they're saying that if they write this up, it will be complex and confusing, which is code for they haven't got a clue what to say. So they're going to stop writing and they're going to have a period of, quote, targeted engagement to try and figure out what to do next.
What is targeted engagement?
Your guess is as good as mine. When you don't know what to do, and maybe this is a lesson we should all take away, when your boss says, what are you doing, and you haven't got a clue, just say, well, we're going to have a period of targeted engagement. Because it sounds quite positive. It doesn't mean anything. Ask people what can we do? What are we going to do now? Say that repeatedly. That's targeted engagement.
I think you might be a little bit harsh there. I wonder whether targeted engagement is that they're going to get their psychology teams out talking to the public to find out why the public don't like the scheme. And then the government will try and rework the scheme so the public come up with the right answer, which is that they accept the named person scheme. Mm. So you might be being a little harsh on them.
No, it's much worse than that. The position they're in is much worse than you could possibly imagine. The next slide has got Simon Calvert here. Now, he's called it out. He said that the independent panel announced in November 2017, so they've been at this for over a year. So we've written a European treaty in the time they've been trying to sort this out, was meant to come up with that code. After the year of trying, they've effectively admitted defeat. They're telling Swinney there should be no new code, which means no new information sharing law. This would leave us with with named person light, subject to the same laws and guidance on information sharing as everybody else. Now, this is quite correct. Okay, so they were asked to come up with something and they looked at this and it's unlawful. And GDPR has come along and it's solidified all this and it's quite clearly unlawful. So they can't write a code of practice to explain how to do the unlawful thing. So they're just going to kind of try to back off slowly and not look too bad. Now, the problem on the ground, though, is that this scheme is still being run out and people are still acting on individual Scottish families using this scheme, even though it's unlawful. And they're turning up and saying, well, OK, it's not actually come through Parliament, but technically I'm a named person. And then they're essentially assembling information on families. Now, what they're doing with that information, we don't know. But it all looks very dodgy. There's a petition asking for a public inquiry. The government is obviously resisting that.
Okay, so are we gonna leave it with this one, Brian, or do you want to continue on a little bit?
Well, I think we should end on the accident, really.
Okay.
That's a vital piece of news.
So just before we do that, we're just going to say, we really do need your support. If you like what we're doing, please consider joining the UK Column community. You can do that by going to ukcolumn.org/community, and the various options are there. We'd like to encourage people, if you're able to possibly do it, to take out lifetime memberships, because that is that's the thing that keeps us going, really. And please do join if you can, no matter what level you want to join at.
Absolutely true. And we're going to say a big thank you to the person who came to visit us from Portugal. We thought that was really quite exceptional that somebody was so keen to come and meet us in person, because they said that what we were producing was of such high quality that they travelled to Plymouth from Portugal to come and say hello. I'd also like to say thank you to other overseas viewers. We know you're there, but although it's becoming increasingly obvious that we've got some form of shadow censorship operating on us, we know by the volume of emails and messages and letters and cards that we get that the viewership is growing overseas. And we'll say hello today to viewers from the States as well.
So we're going to end on this then. Shocking news, Brian, that Prince Philip has had a pretty unpleasant accident. But apparently it's really only Prince Philip we need to worry about.
Yeah, when I listened to the BBC reports, Mike, which came out, and of course I was desperately concerned he might have been hurt, but obviously there was nobody else involved in this accident at all. And well, now it emerges that, of course, other people were involved in the accident, and there was even a baby involved. But that baby seems to mysteriously come into some BBC reports and then disappear. Mm. I find it outrageous that this gentleman should have been driving at the age of 97. When there have been serious accidents in the Plymouth area, the drivers have instantly been arrested. Mm. That's the first thing that's happened. So my question is, was he arrested? And if not, why not? And the second thing is, was he breathalyzed?
He was breathalyzed.
Okay, so he was breathalyzed but not arrested. So clearly now we are seeing that we're living in a country with just two completely different systems. You've given part of it, David. The Scottish government can simply break the law to try and get policies through, where if you're a member of the Buckingham Palace Old Boys Club, you can do what you like. Am I being too hard on the elderly gentleman?
You're not being too hard on the society, right? Because one of the things that we're losing here is the idea that we're all equal in a common law jurisdiction. The Archbishop of York tweeted out, you know, that his prayers and concerns for the Duke, and then a couple of hours later tweeted out, oh yes, I'm the other people involved in the accident.
Yeah.
Now that doesn't look good, but it does go towards a state of mind where we're forgetting that we're all equal in a common law jurisdiction. And that enables the state to act in certain ways, because when the named person comes into the house and starts ordering people about and starts judging the new parents or starts, you know, making inquiries that they've no part in being involved in, they're not showing the door. They're not just I'm not having this, get out. Because there's deep down, there's a fear in people that they don't know how the state will react if they're resisted. Right? And it's that fear we have to eliminate.
Indeed we do. And one of the best ways of doing that is to be talking about what's happening, not only privately, but publicly as well. So certainly UK Column will continue to do that. David, thank you very much for joining us. We will be back at the same time on Monday. Thank you for joining us, and thank you again to all those overseas viewers and the UK ones as well. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.